and after probing around in the dark for a while, I found this man sitting in front of some displays. He was doing some kind of psychometrics, and he was clearly an interesting fellow. I got interested in what he was doing and in his apparatus, and as I recall, I suggested to him that he could achieve the same results by using a computer. The man was Licklider. Clark invited Lick to come down the hall to see the TX-2 and learn some fundamentals. Teaching Lick actually to program the machine would have been too difficult. Programming a computer like the TX-2 was something of a black art. The TX-2, which contained 64,000 bytes of memory, as much as a universal remote control device today, took up a couple of rooms. What, many years later, became tiny microchips for the computer's central processing unit were, in those days, huge racks of many separate plug-in units, each consisting of dozens of transistors and associated electronic parts. Still more space was taken up with large consoles covered with switches and indicator lights to help the operator or troubleshooter understand what the system was doing. All of this equipment required rack upon rack of gear, only a tiny fraction of which, the video display screen and keyboard, might be recognizable today as ordinary computer parts. To sit at the TX-2 with Lick was to be embedded in a welter of seemingly irrelevant stuff, Clark said. To become a TX-2 user would have been a daunting exercise, even for someone as quick as Licklider. For one thing, there were no teaching tools per se, no instructional aids or help menus. For another, the operating system, which would standardize programming for the machine, had yet to be written. One thing the TX-2 did do very well was display information on video screens. That made it one of the earliest machines for interactive graphics work. It was this feature that helped Clark demonstrate for Lick the main ideas of interactive use. The sessions with Clark made an indelible impression on Lick. He drifted further from psychology and toward computer science. As his interests changed, Lick's belief in the potential for computers to transform society became something of an obsession. Succumbing to the lure of computing, he began spending hours at a time at the interactive display console. Louise believed that if he weren't being paid for this work, he'd have paid to do it. The idea on which Lick's worldview pivoted was that technological progress would save humanity. The political process was a favorite example of his. In a McLuhan-esque view of the power of electronic media, Lick saw a future in which, thanks in large part to the reach of computers, most citizens would be informed about and interested in and involved in the process of government. He imagined what he called home computer consoles and television sets linked together in a massive network. "The political process," he wrote, "would essentially be a giant teleconference, and a campaign would be a months-long series of communications among candidates, propagandists, commentators, political action groups, and voters. The key is the self-motivating exhilaration that accompanies true effective interaction with information through a good console and a good network to a good computer." Lick's thoughts about the role computers would play in people's lives hit a crescendo in 1960 with the publication of his seminal paper, Man-Computer Symbiosis. In it, he distilled many of his ideas into a central thesis: a close coupling between humans and the electronic members of the partnership would eventually result in cooperative decision-making. Moreover, decisions would be made by humans using computers, without what Lick called inflexible dependence on predetermined programs. He held to the view that computers would naturally continue to be used for what they do best, all of the rote work, and this would free humans to devote energy to making better decisions and developing clearer insights than they would be capable of without computers. Together, Lick suggested, man and machine would perform far more competently than either could alone. Moreover, attacking problems in partnership with computers could save the most valuable of postmodern resources, time. "The hope," Licklider wrote, "is that not in too many years human brains and computing machines would be coupled, tightly, and that the resulting partnership will think as no human brain has ever thought, and process data in a way not approached by the information-handling machines we know today. Licklider's ideas, which had their beginnings just a few years earlier in a chance encounter in the basement of Lincoln Lab, represented some of the most daring and imaginative thinking of the day. One former MIT student, Robert Rosen, who had taken an experimental psychology course from Lick in 1956 and later went into computer science, read Man-Computer Symbiosis and was awestruck by the elder's intellectual versatility. "For the life of me, I could not imagine how a psychologist, who, in 1956, had no apparent knowledge of computers, could have written such a profound and insightful paper about my field in 1960," Rosen said. "Lick's paper made a deep impression on me and refined my own realization that a new age of computing was upon us." In the moment that Licklider published the paper, his reputation as a computer scientist was fixed forever. He shed the mantle of psychology and took on computing. There was no turning him back. A couple of years before the paper was published, Licklider had left MIT to work at a small consulting and research firm in Cambridge called Bolt, Baranek & Newman. The company had agreed to buy him two computers for his research, and he was having the time of his life. One day in 1962, ARPA Director Jack Ruina called Licklider with a new job possibility. What would Lick say to taking on not just ARPA's command and control division, but a new behavioral sciences division as well? And there'd be a huge computer, the Q32, thrown into the deal. Ruina also called on Fred Frick, a friend and colleague of Lick's at Lincoln Lab. Frick and Licklider met with Ruina together. Licklider went in prepared just to listen, but was soon waxing eloquent on the topic. The problems of command and control, he told Ruina, were essentially problems of human-computer interaction. "I thought it was just ridiculous to be having command and control systems based on batch processing," he recalled years later. "Who can direct a battle when he's got to write the program in the middle of the battle?" Licklider and Frick agreed that the job seemed interesting, but neither wanted to leave what he was doing. Ruina's sales pitch was so intense, however, and he made the mission seem so critical, that Frick and Licklider decided one of them should do it. They tossed a coin, and Lick accepted the position on the condition that he be given the freedom to lead the program in any direction he saw fit. Partly because Ruina was very busy, and partly because he didn't understand computers himself, he agreed to the proviso without hesitation. Lick belonged to a small group of computer scientists who believed that people could be much more effective if they had at their fingertips a computer system with good displays and good databases. Before moving to Washington in the fall of 1962, Lick gave a series of computer seminars at the Pentagon, well attended by Defense Department and military officials. His message, already something of a mantra up in Cambridge, but still largely unfamiliar to a military audience, was that a computer should be something anyone could interact with directly, eliminating computer operators as the middlemen in solving their problems. To this end, Lick saw great promise in time-sharing, and was one of its most ardent evangelists. Time-sharing didn't exactly put a computer on everyone's desk, but it created the illusion of just that. It brought the power of the computer right to everyone's fingertips. It gave people a strong feel for the machine. The promotion of time-sharing was by no means Lick's sole mission when he arrived at ARPA. He was just as keen on exploring the ideas that had been percolating around human-machine interaction for several years. When Lick arrived for his first day at work, on October 1, 1962, his secretary said, "Well, Dr. Licklider, you have just one appointment today. There are some gentlemen coming from the Bureau of the Budget to review your program." When the budget officers arrived, they were amused to discover it was Licklider's first day. There wasn't much of substance to discuss yet. The command and control program consisted of one $9 million contract with System Development Corporation, and the remaining $5 million or so in the budget was still unassigned. Instead of a budget review, the meeting was transformed into a private colloquium, in which Lick expounded on such topics as time-sharing, interactive computing, and artificial intelligence. Like many others before them, the accountants were infected by Licklider's enthusiasm.
"I told them what I was excited about, and that turned out to work greatly to my favor, because they got interested in it," he said later. "And when we did have a meeting on it, they did not take any of my money away."
The principal charter he'd been given was to come up with uses for computers other than as tools for numerical scientific calculations. Lick developed new programs, partly as a reaction against some of the applications the Defense Department had in mind for large computers. Air Force intelligence, for instance, wanted to harness huge mainframes to detect patterns of behavior among high-level Soviet officials. The computer would be fed intelligence information from a variety of human sources, such as hearsay from cocktail parties or observations at a May Day parade, and try to develop a best-guess scenario on what the Soviets might be up to. The idea was that you take this powerful computer and feed it all this qualitative information, such as, "The Air Force chief drank two martinis," or "Khrushchev isn't reading Pravda on Mondays," recalled Rowena. And the computer would play Sherlock Holmes and conclude that the Russians must be building an MX-72 missile or something like that. First Rowena, then Licklider tried putting a stop to such asinine kinds of things, as Lick described the ill-conceived projects. Then Lick worked to find the country's foremost computer centers and set up research contracts with them. In short order, he had reached out to the best computer scientists of the day, from Stanford, MIT, UCLA, Berkeley, and a handful of companies, bringing them into ARPA's sphere. All told, there were about a dozen in Lick's inner circle, which Rowena called Lick's priesthood. In typical fashion, where his most passionate beliefs masqueraded as a bit of a joke, Licklider nicknamed it the Intergalactic Computer Network. 6 months after his arrival at ARPA, Lick wrote a lengthy memo to the members of the Intergalactic Network in which he expressed his frustration over the proliferation of disparate programming languages, debugging systems, time-sharing system control language, and documentation schemes. "Consider the situation in which several different centers are netted together, each center being highly individualistic and having its own special language and its own special way of doing things," he posited. "Is it not desirable or even necessary for all the centers to agree upon some language, or at least upon some conventions for asking such questions as, 'What language do you speak?' At this extreme, the problem is essentially the one discussed by science fiction writers. How do you get communication started among totally uncorrelated sapient beings?" That said, Lick hedged his bets. "It will possibly turn out," he continued, "that only on rare occasions do most or all of the computers in the overall system operate together in an integrated network. It seems to me to be important, nevertheless, to develop a capability for integrated network operation." And therein lay the seed of Licklider's grandest vision yet. He would extend the concept of the Intergalactic Network to mean not just a group of people to whom he was sending memos, but a universe of interconnected computers over which all might send their memos. Licklider was no exception to the rule that people didn't spend a long time at ARPA, but by the time he left in 1964, he had succeeded in shifting the agency's emphasis in computing R&D from a command systems laboratory playing out wargame scenarios to advanced research in time-sharing systems, computer graphics, and improved computer languages. The name of the office, Command and Control Research, had changed to reflect that shift, becoming the Information Processing Techniques Office. Licklider chose his successor, a colleague named Ivan Sutherland, the world's leading expert in computer graphics. In 1965, Sutherland hired a young hotshot named Bob Taylor, who would soon sit down in ARPA's terminal room and wonder why, with so many computers, they were unable to communicate with one another. Bob Taylor had started college in Dallas at the age of 16, thinking he would follow his father's footsteps and become a minister. His family never lived in one place very long, moving from one Methodist church to another around Texas, in towns with names like Uvalde, Victoria, and Ozona. But instead of the service of the Lord, Taylor entered the service of the U.S. Navy when his reserve unit was called to active duty for the Korean War. Taylor spent the war at the Dallas Naval Air Station, the USS Neverfloat, he called it. At the end of the war, he entered the University of Texas on the GI Bill with no particular course of study in mind. He finally graduated in 1957 with a major in psychology and a minor in mathematics. Taylor pursued his love for science into graduate school at UT and wrote his dissertation on psychoacoustics, a field from which some people were making a leap into computing. Taylor jumped too. "When I was in graduate school, there was no computer science," Taylor recollected, "so I didn't really have much of an introduction to computing. But I began to feel that computing research was going to be much more rewarding." Fresh from school, Taylor held a few jobs in the aerospace industry before landing a job at NASA in 1961, where he worked as a program officer in Washington, D.C., in the Office of Advanced Research and Technology. One day in 1963, Taylor was invited to join an unofficial committee of government program managers, all of whom were involved in funding computer research. It was an informal group that simply exchanged information about their projects, looking for ways of collaborating, and tried to avoid duplication or overlap. The invitation had come, as it turned out, from someone who had been Taylor's intellectual role model in psychoacoustics, J.C.R. Licklider. He was head of the committee. Licklider's early work in psychoacoustics had deeply influenced Taylor's own, and he welcomed the chance to meet the illustrious Licklider. Taylor was struck by how unassuming he was. "He flattered me right off by saying he knew my thesis work," Taylor said. Here was a man with a giant reputation who was probably one of the nicest, most easygoing people Taylor had ever met. When Taylor first joined the committee, Licklider was in the process of pulling together the computer science community under ARPA, the new generation of researchers drawn to interactive computing. They were busily framing their bold new perspective, radically different from the mainstream in computer research and development during the previous two decades. Mountains of money and years of work had been invested in improving the technical parameters of speed, reliability, and memory size of computers. But this small avant-garde of researchers, concentrated at MIT and around Boston, had begun working on making the computer an amplifier of human potential, an extension of the mind and body. Taylor was known for having a good bit of intuition himself. He was considered a far-sighted program officer who had a knack for picking innovative winners, both projects and researchers. He joined ARPA in early 1965, following Licklider's departure, to work as deputy to Ivan Sutherland, IPTO's second director. Months later, in 1966, at the age of 34, Taylor became the third director of IPTO, inheriting responsibility for the community and much of the vision, indeed the very office established by Licklider. The only difference, which turned out to be crucial, was that ARPA, now headed by Charles Hertzfeld, an Austrian physicist who had fled Europe during the war, was even faster and looser with its money than it had been during Rowena's tenure. A joke now circulated among its program directors. "Come up with a good idea for a research program, and it will take you about 30 minutes to get the funding." The terminal problem, as Taylor called it, was a source of frustration not just for him, but for Sutherland before him and for Licklider before that. One day, shortly after becoming IPTO director, Taylor found himself rolling around an idea Lick had discussed with him several times but never actually acted on. Now that it was his watch, Taylor decided to act. Taylor headed straight to Hertzfeld's office. No memos, no meetings. Other program directors were slightly intimidated by Hertzfeld, a large man with a thick, rumbling Viennese accent. But Taylor saw nothing to fear about the man. In fact, Taylor behaved like such a good old boy around his boss that someone once asked him, "Taylor, what have you got with Hertzfeld? You must be related to Lyndon Johnson. You're both from Texas, aren't you?" Taylor told the ARPA director he needed to discuss funding for a networking experiment he had in mind. Hertzfeld had talked about networking with Taylor a bit already, so the idea wasn't new to him. He had also visited Taylor's office, where he witnessed the annoying exercise of logging onto three different computers. And a few years earlier, he had even fallen under the spell of Licklider himself, when he attended Lick's lectures on interactive computing. Taylor gave his boss a quick briefing. IPTO contractors, most of whom were at research universities, were beginning to request more and more computer resources. Every principal investigator, it seemed, wanted his own computer. Not only was there an obvious duplication of effort across the research community, but it was getting damned expensive. Computers weren't small, and they weren't cheap. Why not try tying them all together? By building a system of electronic links between machines, researchers doing similar work in different parts of the country could share resources and results more easily. Instead of spreading a half-dozen expensive mainframes across the country devoted to supporting advanced graphics research, ARPA could concentrate resources in one or two places and build a way for everyone to get at them. One university might concentrate on one thing, another research center could be funded to concentrate on something else. But regardless of where you were physically located, you would have access to it all. He suggested that ARPA fund a small test network, starting with, say, four nodes and building up to a dozen or so. The Defense Department was the largest buyer of computers in the world. Investing in a particular make of computer was no trivial decision, and it often put the different services in a bind, particularly when faced with a federal rule dictating that all manufacturers be given equal opportunity. There seemed to be no hope of curtailing the purchase of a whole variety of machines, and the chances seemed slim to non-existent that the computing world would gravitate anytime soon to a set of uniform operating standards. Research sponsors like ARPA would just have to find some other way of overcoming the industry's incompatibility problems. If the network idea worked, Taylor told Hertzfeld, it would be possible for computers from different manufacturers to connect, and the problem of choosing computers would be greatly diminished. Hertzfeld was so taken with that possibility that those arguments alone might have been enough to convince him. But there was another advantage, centering on the question of reliability. It might be possible to connect computers in a network redundantly, so that if one line went down, a message could take another path. "Is it going to be hard to do?" Hertzfeld asked. "Oh, no, we already know how to do it," Taylor responded with characteristic boldness. "Great idea," Hertzfeld said. "Get it going. You've got $1 million more in your budget right now. Go." Taylor left Hertzfeld's office on the E-ring and headed back to the corridor that connected to the D-ring and his own office. He glanced at his watch. "Jesus Christ," he said to himself softly, "that only took 20 minutes." Chapter 2. A block here, some stones there. By the time Taylor assumed the directorship of IPTO in 1966, manifestations of Licklider's philosophy were evident throughout the computer research establishment. The ranks of researchers hoping to extend the computer beyond the status of a calculating instrument continued to grow throughout the decade. Some of the earliest and most important work in interactive graphics and virtual reality was taking place at the University of Utah using ARPA money. MIT, in particular, seemed to breed one groundbreaking development after another. There, Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert were engaged in important early work in artificial intelligence. Programs at other institutions focused on advanced programming techniques, time-sharing, and computer languages. Building a network as an end in itself wasn't Taylor's principal objective. He was trying to solve a problem he had seen grow worse with each round of funding. Researchers were duplicating and isolating costly computing resources. Not only were the scientists at each other's site engaging in more and more diverse computer research, but their demands for computer resources were growing faster than Taylor's budget. Every new project required setting up a new and costly computing operation. Depending on the computer being used and the number of graduate students being supported, IPTO's individual grants ranged from $500,000 to $3 million. And none of the resources or results was easily shared. If the scientists doing graphics in Salt Lake City wanted to use the programs developed by the people at Lincoln Lab, they had to fly to Boston. Still more frustrating if, after a trip to Boston, people in Utah wanted to start a similar project on their own machine, they would need to spend considerable time and money duplicating what they had just seen. In those days, software programs were one of a kind, like original works of art, and not easily transferred from one machine to another. Taylor was convinced of the technical feasibility of sharing such resources over a computer network, though it had never been done. Beyond cost-cutting, Taylor's idea revealed something very profound. A machine's ability to amplify human intellectual power was precisely what Linklater had had in mind while writing his paper on human-machine symbiosis 6 years earlier. Of course, Linklater's ideas about time-sharing were already bearing fruit at universities all over the country. But the networking idea marked a significant departure from time-sharing. In a resource-sharing network, many machines would serve many different users, and a researcher interested in using, say, a particular graphics program on a machine 2,000 miles away would simply log on to that machine. The idea of one computer reaching out to tap resources inside another, as peers in a collaborative organization, represented the most advanced conception yet to emerge from Licklider's vision. Taylor had the money, and he had Hertzfeld's support. But he needed a program manager who could oversee the design and construction of such a network, someone who not only knew Licklider's ideas but believed in them. This person had to be a first-rate computer scientist, comfortable with a wide range of technical issues. How it was to be achieved didn't concern Taylor greatly, as long as the network was reliable and fast. Those were his priorities. Interactive computing meant you'd get a quick response from a computer, so in the modern computing environment it made sense that a network also should be highly responsive. And to be useful, it had to be working any time you needed it. Whoever designed such a network needed to be an expert in telecommunication systems as well. But Taylor already had someone in mind, a shy, deep-thinking young computer scientist from the Lincoln Lab's breeding ground named Larry Roberts. In early 1966, Roberts was at Lincoln working on graphics, but he had also done quite a lot of work in communications. He had just completed one of the most relevant proof-of-principle experiments in networking to date, hooking together two computers a continent apart. Taylor had funded Roberts's experiment. It had been successful enough to build Taylor's confidence and convince both himself and Hertzfeld that a slightly more intricate network was feasible. And Roberts's knowledge of computers went deep. The son of Yale chemists, Roberts had attended MIT and received his introduction to computers on the TX-0. Although it was the first transistorized digital computer, the TX-0 was limited. Subtraction was not in its repertoire. It could subtract only by adding a negative number. Using the TX-0, Roberts taught himself the basics of computer design and operation. Roberts, in fact, had written the entire operating system for its successor, the TX-2 computer at Lincoln, which Wes Clark, who built the TX-0 with Ken Olson, had fatefully shown off to Licklider. When Clark left Lincoln in 1964, the job of overseeing the TX-2 had fallen to Roberts. Taylor didn't know Roberts very well. No one, it seemed, knew Roberts very well. He was as reserved in his manner as Taylor was open in his. The people with whom Roberts worked most closely knew almost nothing about his personal life. What was known about him was that, in addition to computing and telecommunications expertise, he had a knack for management. Roberts's style was simple, direct, unambiguous, and terribly effective. Roberts had a reputation for being something of a genius. At 28, he had done more in the field of computing than many scientists were to achieve in a lifetime. Blessed with incredible stamina, he worked inordinately late hours. He was also a quick study. More than a few people had had the experience of explaining to Roberts something they had been working on intensively for years, and finding that within a few minutes he had grasped it, turned it around in his head a couple of times, and offered trenchant comments of his own. Roberts reminded Taylor of Licklider a little, but without Lick's sense of humor. Roberts was also known for his nearly obsessive ability to immerse himself in a challenge, pouring intense powers of concentration into a problem. A colleague once recalled the time Roberts took a speed reading course. He quickly doubled his already rapid reading rate, but he didn't stop there. He delved into the professional literature of speed reading and kept pushing himself until he was reading at the phenomenal rate of about 30,000 words a minute with 10% selective comprehension, as Roberts described it. After a few months, Roberts's limiting factor had nothing to do with his eyes or his brain, but with the speed at which he could turn the pages. "He'd pick up a paperback and be through with it in 10 minutes," the friend observed. "It was typical Larry." Taylor called Roberts and told him he liked to come to Boston to see him. A few days later, Taylor was sitting in Roberts's office at Lincoln Lab, telling him about the experiment he had in mind. As Taylor talked, Roberts murmured a nasal, "Mm-hmm," as if to say, "Please go on." Taylor outlined not just the project, but a job offer. Roberts would be hired as program director for the experimental network, with the understanding that he would be next in line for the IPTO directorship. Taylor made it clear that this project had the full support of ARPA's director and that Roberts would be given ample latitude to design and build the network however he saw fit. Taylor waited for an answer. "I'll think about it," Roberts said flatly. Taylor read this as Roberts's polite way of saying no, and he left Boston discouraged. Under any other circumstances, he'd have simply crossed Roberts off the list and called his second choice. But he didn't have a second choice. Not only did Roberts have the necessary technical understanding, but Taylor knew he would listen to Licklider and Wes Clark, both of whom were supporting Taylor's idea. A few weeks later, Taylor made a second trip to Lincoln. This time, Roberts was more forthcoming. He told Taylor politely but unequivocally that he was enjoying his work at Lincoln and had no desire to become a Washington bureaucrat. Disconsolate, Taylor went to Cambridge to visit Lick, who was now back at MIT, ensconced in a research effort on timesharing called Project Mac. They discussed who else might be well suited to the job. Lick suggested a few people, but Taylor rejected them. He wanted Roberts. From then on, every 2 months or so, during visits to ARPA's or other Boston-area contractors, Taylor called on Roberts to try to persuade him to change his mind. It had been nearly a year since Taylor's 20-minute conversation with Hertzfeld, and the networking idea was floundering for lack of a program manager. One day in late 1966, Taylor returned to the ARPA director's office. "Isn't it true that ARPA is giving Lincoln at least 51% of its funding?" Taylor asked his boss. "Yes, it is," Hertzfeld responded, slightly puzzled. Taylor then explained the difficulty he was having getting the engineer he wanted to run the networking program. "Who is it?" Hertzfeld asked. Taylor told him. Then he asked his boss another question. Would Hertzfeld call the director of Lincoln Lab and ask him to call Roberts in and tell him that it would be in his own best interest, and in Lincoln's best interest, to agree to take the Washington job? Hertzfeld picked up his telephone and dialed Lincoln Lab. He got the director online and said just what Taylor had asked him to say. It was a short conversation, but from what Taylor could tell, Hertzfeld encountered no resistance. Hertzfeld hung up, smiled at Taylor, and said, "Well, okay, we'll see what happens." 2 weeks later, Roberts accepted the job. Larry Roberts was 29 years old when he walked into the Pentagon as ARPA's newest draftee. He fit in quickly, and his dislike of idle time soon became legendary. Within a few weeks he had the place, one of the world's largest, most labyrinthine buildings, memorized. Getting around the building was complicated by the fact that certain hallways were blocked off as classified areas. Roberts obtained a stopwatch and began timing various routes to his frequent destinations. Larry's route soon became commonly known as the fastest distance between any two Pentagon points. Even before his first day at ARPA, Roberts had a rudimentary outline of the computer network figured out. Then, and for years afterward as the project grew, Roberts drew meticulous network diagrams, sketching out where the data line should go and the number of hops between nodes. On tracing paper and quadrille paper, he created hundreds of conceptual and logical sketches. Later, after the project was underway, Roberts would arrange with Howard Frank, an expert in the field of network topology, to carry out computer-based analyses of how to lay out the network most cost-effectively. Still, for years, Roberts had the network's layout and the technical particulars that defined it sharply pictured inside his head. A lot was already known about how to build complicated communications networks to carry voice, sound, and other more elemental signals. AT&T, of course, had absolute hegemony when it came to the telephone network. But the systematic conveyance of information predated Ma Bell by at least a few thousand years. Messenger systems date at least as far back as the reign of Egyptian king Sesostris I, almost 4,000 years ago. The first relay system, where a message was passed from one guard station to the next, came about in 650 BC. For hundreds of years thereafter, invention was driven by the necessity for greater speed, as the transmission of messages from one place to another progressed through pigeons, shouters, coded flags, mirrors, lanterns, torches, and beacons. Then, in 1793, the first tidings were exchanged using semaphores, pivoting vanes on a tower that resembled a person holding signal flags in outstretched arms. By the mid-1800s, telegraph networks were relying on electricity, and Western Union Telegraph Company had begun blanketing the United States with a network of wires for transmitting messages in the form of electric pulses. The telegraph was a classic early example of what is called a store and forward network. Because of electrical losses, the signals had to be switched forward through a sequence of relay stations. At first, messages arrived at switching centers were transcribed by hand and forwarded via Morse code to the next station. Later, arriving messages were stored automatically on typed paper ribbons until an operator could retype the message for the next leg. By 1903, arriving messages were encoded on a snippet of paper tape as a series of small holes, and the torn tape was hung on a hook. Tapes were taken in turn from the hooks by clerks and fed through a tape reader that automatically forwarded them by Morse code. By the middle of the 20th century, after the telephone had supplanted the telegraph as the primary means of communication, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company held a complete, albeit strictly regulated, monopoly on long-distance communications within the United States. The company was tenacious about its stronghold on both telephone service and the equipment that made such service possible. Attachment of foreign, non-Bell equipment to Bell lines was forbidden, on the grounds that foreign devices could damage the entire telephone system. Everything added to the system had to work with existing equipment. In the early 1950s, a company began manufacturing a device called a hushaphone, a plastic mouthpiece cover designed to permit a caller to speak into a telephone without being overheard. AT&T succeeded in having the Federal Communications Commission ban the device, after presenting expert witnesses who described how the hushaphone damaged the telephone system by reducing telephone quality. In another example of AT&T's zeal, the company sued an undertaker in the Midwest who was giving out free plastic phone book covers. AT&T argued that a plastic phone book cover obscured the advertisement on the cover of the Yellow Pages and reduced the value of the paid advertising, revenues that helped reduce the cost of telephone service. There was almost no way to bring radical new technology into the Bell system to coexist with the old. It wasn't until 1968 when the FCC permitted the use of the Carter phone, a device for connecting private two-way radios with the telephone system, that AT&T's unrelenting grip on the nation's telecommunications system loosened. Not surprisingly, then, in the early 1960s, when ARPA began exploring an entirely new way of transmitting information, AT&T wanted no part of it. Just as living creatures evolve through a process of mutation and natural selection, ideas in science and their applications in technology do the same. Evolution in science, as in nature, normally a gradual sequence of changes, occasionally makes a revolutionary leap, breaking with the course of development. New ideas emerge simultaneously but independently. And so they did when the time was ripe for inventing a new way of transmitting information. In the early 1960s, before Larry Roberts had even set to work creating a new computer network, two other researchers, Paul Barron and Donald Davies, completely unknown to each other and working continents apart toward different goals, arrived at virtually the same revolutionary idea for a new kind of communications network. The realization of their concepts came to be known as packet switching. Paul Barron was a good-humored immigrant from Eastern Europe. He was born in 1926 in what was then Poland. His parents sought refuge in the United States 2 years later, following a lengthy wait for immigration papers. The family arrived in Boston, where Paul's father went to work in a shoe factory, and later settled in Philadelphia, where he opened a small grocery store. As a boy, Paul delivered groceries for his dad using a small red wagon. Once, when he was five, he asked his mother if they were rich or poor.
"We're poor," she responded.
Later, he asked his father the same question.
"We're rich," the older Barron replied, providing his son with the first of many such existential conundrums in his life.
Paul eventually attended school two streetcar hops from home at Drexel Institute of Technology, which later became Drexel University. He was put off by the school's heavy-handed emphasis in those days on rapid numerical problem-solving. Two trivial arithmetic errors on a test, racing against a clock, and you failed, regardless of whether or not you fundamentally understood the problems. At the time, Drexel was trying to create a reputation for itself as a tough, no-nonsense place, and took pride in its high dropout rate. Drexel instructors told their budding engineers that employers wanted only those who could calculate quickly and correctly. To his dismay, Barron saw many bright, imaginative friends forced out by the school's macho attitude toward math. But he stuck it out, and in 1949 earned a degree in electrical engineering. Jobs were scarce, so he took the first offer that came, from the Eckert Mauchly Computer Corporation. In the relatively mundane capacity of technician, he tested parts for radio tubes and germanium diodes on the first commercial computer, the UNIVAC. Barron soon married, and he and his wife moved to Los Angeles, where he took a job at Hughes Aircraft, working on radar data processing systems.
He took night classes at UCLA on computers and transistors, and in 1959 he received a master's degree in engineering. Barron left Hughes in late 1959 to join the computer science department in the mathematics division at the Rand Corporation, while continuing to take classes at UCLA. Barron was ambivalent, but his advisor at UCLA, Jerry Estrin, urged him to continue his studies toward a doctorate. Soon, a heavy travel schedule was forcing him to miss classes. But it was finally divine intervention, he said, that sparked his decision to abandon the doctoral work. "I was driving one day to UCLA from Rand and couldn't find a single parking spot in all of UCLA, nor the entire adjacent town of Westwood," Barron recalled. "At that instant I concluded that it was God's will that I should discontinue school. Why else would he have found it necessary to fill up all the parking lots at that exact instant?" Soon after Barron arrived at Rand, he developed an interest in the survivability of communication systems under nuclear attack. He was motivated primarily by the hovering tensions of the Cold War, not the engineering challenges involved. Both the United States and the Soviet Union were in the process of building hair-trigger nuclear ballistic missile arsenals. By 1960, the escalating arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union heightened the threat of doomsday, nuclear annihilation over daily life in both countries. Barron knew, as did all who understood nuclear weapons and communications technology, that the early command and control systems for missile launch were dangerously fragile. For military leaders, the command part of the equation meant having all the weapons, people, and machines of the modern military at their disposal and being able to get them to do what you want them to do, as one analyst explained. Control meant just the opposite, getting them not to do what you don't want them to. The threat of one country or the other having its command systems destroyed in an attack and being left unable to launch a defensive or retaliatory strike gave rise to what Barron described as a dangerous temptation for either party to misunderstand the actions of the other and fire first. As the strategists at Rand saw it, it was a necessary condition that the communication systems for strategic weapons be able to survive an attack, so the country's retaliatory capability could still function. At the time, the nation's long-distance communications networks were indeed extremely vulnerable and unable to withstand a nuclear attack. Yet the President's ability to call for, or call off, the launch of American missiles, called minimal essential communication, relied heavily on the nation's vulnerable communication systems. So Barron felt that working on the problem of building a more stable communications infrastructure, namely a tougher, more robust network, was the most important work he could be doing. Barron wasn't the first at Rand to think about this problem. In fact, it was Rand's stock in trade to study such things. Rand had been set up in 1946 to preserve the nation's operations research capability developed during World War II. Most of its contracts came from the Air Force. The problem of the communication system's survivability was something that Rand's communications division was working on, but with limited success. Barron was one of the first to determine, at least on a theoretical level, that the problem was indeed solvable. And he was unquestionably the first to see that the way to solve it was by applying digital computer technology. Few of the electronics experts in other departments at Rand knew much about the emerging field of digital computer technology, and even fewer seemed interested. Barron recalled his sense of how different his own thinking was from theirs. "Many of the things I thought possible would tend to sound like utter nonsense or impractical, depending on the generosity of spirit in those brought up in an earlier world." And it wasn't just his colleagues at Rand who cast a skeptical eye on Barron's thinking. The traditional communications community at large quickly dismissed his ideas as not merely racy, but untenable. Instead of shying away, Barron just dove deeper into his work.
Rand allowed investigators sufficient freedom to pursue their own ideas, and by late 1960 Barron's interest and knowledge of networks had grown into a small independent project. Convinced of the merit of his ideas, he embarked on writing a series of comprehensive technical papers to respond to objections previously raised, and explain in increasing detail what he was proposing. The work, as he explained years later, was done not out of intellectual curiosity nor any desire to publish. "It was done in response to the most dangerous situation that ever existed," he said. At the Pentagon, Barron found planners who were thinking in unemotional terms about post-attack scenarios, and making quantitative estimates of the destruction that would result from a Soviet nuclear ballistic missile attack. "The possibility of a war exists, but there is much that can be done to minimize the consequences," Barron wrote. "If war does not mean the end of the earth in a black-and-white manner, then it follows that we should do those things that make the shade of gray as light as possible. To plan now to minimize potential destruction, and to do all those things necessary to permit the survivors of the Holocaust to shuck their ashes and reconstruct the economy swiftly." Barron's first paper revealed glimpses of his nascent revolutionary ideas about the theory and structure of communications networks. He had arrived tentatively at the notion that a data network could be made more robust and reliable by introducing higher levels of redundancy. Computers were key. Independently of Licklider and others in computing's avant-garde, Barron saw well beyond mainstream computing, to the future of digital technologies and the symbiosis between humans and machines. Barron was working on the problem of how to build communication structures whose surviving components could continue to function as a cohesive entity after other pieces were destroyed. He had long talks with Warren McCullough, an eminent psychiatrist at MIT's Research Laboratory of Electronics. They discussed the brain, its neural net structures, and what happens when some portion is diseased, particularly how brain functions can sometimes recover by sidestepping a dysfunctional region. "Well, gee, you know," Barron remembered thinking, "the brain seems to have some of the properties that one would need for real stability." It struck him as significant that brain functions didn't rely on a single, unique, dedicated set of cells. This is why damaged cells can be bypassed as neural nets recreate themselves over new pathways in the brain. The notion of dividing a single, large, vulnerable structure into many parts, as a defense mechanism, can be seen in many other applications. The concept is not entirely dissimilar to the idea of segmented or compartmentalized structures used in modern ship hulls or gasoline tanker trucks. If only one or two areas of the skin are ruptured, only a section of the overall structure loses its utility, not the whole thing. Some terrorist groups and espionage operations employ a similar kind of compartmentalized organization to thwart authorities, who might eliminate one cell without jeopardizing the whole group. Theoretically, it might be possible to set up a network with numerous redundant connections, and you would start getting structures sort of like neural nets, Barron said. But there was a technical limitation, since all signals on the telephone network were analog signals. The telephone switching plan prohibited more than 5 links to be connected in tandem, because signal quality deteriorated rapidly with the increased number of tandem links. At each switched link, the signal would be slightly distorted and the quality incrementally degraded. This is similar to what happens when one makes copies of audio tapes. With each new generation, the quality deteriorates, eventually becoming hopelessly distorted. Unlike analog systems, digital technologies essentially convert information of all kinds, including sound and image, to a set of ones and zeros. Digitized information can be stored efficiently and replicated an unlimited number of times within the circuits of a digital device, reproducing the data with almost perfect accuracy. In a communications context,
Information that is digitally encoded can be passed from one switch to the next with much less degradation than in analog transmission. As Barron wrote in his initial paper, "The timing for such thinking is particularly appropriate now, for we are just beginning to lay out designs for the digital data transmission system of the future." Technologists could realistically envision new systems where computers would speak to one another, allowing for a network with enough sequentially connected links to create adequate levels of redundancy. These link structures resemble, in a very modest way, the astonishingly complicated billions of linkages among the neurons in the brain. And digital computers offered speed. Mechanical telephone switches of the time took 20 or 30 seconds just to establish a single long-distance connection over a typical phone line. In speaking to various military commanders, Barron found that adequate communication in wartime requires the transmission of much more data than the conceptual minimum essential communications. Exactly how much more was hard to know, so Barron changed the objective to a network able to support almost any imaginable traffic volume. Barron's basic theoretical network configuration was as simple as it was dramatically different and new. Telephone networks have always been constructed using central switching points. The most vulnerable are those centralized networks with all paths leading into a single nerve center. The other common design is a decentralized network, with several main nerve centers around which links are clustered, with a few long lines connecting between clusters. This is basically how the long-distance phone system still looks in schematic terms today. Barron's idea constituted a third approach to network design. He called his a distributed network. "Avoid having a central communication switch," he said, "and build a network composed of many nodes, each redundantly connected to its neighbor." His original diagram showed a network of interconnected nodes resembling a distorted lattice or fishnet. The question remained, how much redundancy in the interconnections between neighboring nodes would be needed for survivability? Redundancy level was Barron's term for the degree of connectivity between nodes in the network. A distributed network with the absolute minimum number of links necessary to connect each node was said to have a redundancy level of 1, and was considered extremely vulnerable. Barron ran numerous simulations to determine the probability of distributed network survival under a variety of attack scenarios. He concluded that a redundancy level as low as 3 or 4, each node connecting to 3 or 4 other nodes, would provide an exceptionally high level of ruggedness and reliability. "Just a redundancy level of maybe 3 or 4 would permit almost as robust a network as the theoretical limit," he said. "Even after a nuclear attack, it should be possible to find and use some pathway through the remaining network." That was a most fortunate finding, because it meant that we would not need to buy a huge amount of redundancy to build survivable networks, Barron said. Even low-cost, unreliable links would suffice as long as there were at least 3 times the minimum number of them. Barron's second idea was still more revolutionary. Fracture the messages, too. By dividing each message into parts, you could flood the network with what he called message blocks, all racing over different paths to their destination. Upon their arrival, a receiving computer would reassemble the message bits into readable form. Conceptually, this was an approach borrowed more from the world of freight movers than communications experts. Think of each message as if it were a large house, and ask yourself how you would move that house across the country, from, say, Boston to Los Angeles. Theoretically, you could move the whole structure in one piece. House movers do it over shorter distance all the time, slowly and carefully. However, it's more efficient to disassemble the structure if you can, load the pieces onto trucks, and then drive those trucks over the nation's interstate highway system, another kind of distributed network. Not every truck would take the same route. Some drivers might go through Chicago and some through Nashville.
If a driver learns that the road is bad around Kansas City, for example, he may take an alternate route. As long as each driver has clear instructions telling him where to deliver his load, and he is told to take the fastest way he can find, chances are that all the pieces will arrive at their destination in L.A., and the house can be reassembled on a new site. In some cases, the last truck to leave Boston might be the first to arrive in L.A. But if each piece of the house carries a label indicating its place in the overall structure, the order of the arrival doesn't matter. The rebuilders can find the right parts and put them together in the right places. In Barron's model, these pieces were what he called message blocks, and they were to be of a certain size, just as, in the truck analogy, most tractor-trailer vehicles share the same configuration. The advantage of the packet messaging technique was realized primarily in a distributed network that offered many different routes. Barron's innovation also provided a much-needed solution to the bursty nature of data communications. At the time, all communications networks were circuit-switched, which meant that a communications line was reserved for one call at a time and held open for the duration of that session. A phone call between teenagers will tie up a line for as long as they commiserate over their boyfriends and tell stories about their rivals. Even during pauses in their conversation, the line remains dedicated to that conversation until it ends. And technically, this makes a lot of sense, since people tend to keep up a fairly steady flow of talk during a phone call. But a stream of data is different. It usually pours out in short bursts, followed by empty pauses, that leave the line idle much of the time, wasting its bandwidth or capacity. One well-known computer scientist liked to use the example of a bakery with one counter clerk, where customers usually arrive in random bursts. The clerk has to stay at the counter throughout the day,